Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How will China and India change the balance of the global economy? With combined populations of 2.4 billion people, these Asian giants have already been recognized in the West as vast sources of inexpensive labor. But my guest today would argue that multinational corporations whose visions of India and China end there stand to lose out on significant growth and billions of dollars in revenues. So what else is there to understand and to act upon with regard to India and China? Anil K. Gupta is here to talk about that. He is professor of strategy and organization at the University of Maryland at College Park. His new book, written with Haiyan Wang, is called Getting India and China Right, Strategies for Leveraging the World's Fastest Growing Economies for Global Advantage. Anil, welcome to Think.
Good to be here, Chris.
So while most U.S. companies that operate in India and or China have only one or two objectives, you write that there are four that need to be considered, starting with huge potential consumer markets. What has to happen for companies to successfully sell in India and China?
I think the key really is, what market should the company be targeting in China and India? And essentially, historically, the vast majority of companies have targeted just the cream at the top. You know, it's almost like the top 5% of the income population. But the size of the market, the growth of the market, or the bulk of the market over the next 20 years is actually in the middle of the pyramid. And in order to go after that market, the buying power is extremely low. You know, it's about 1/17th per capita income relative to U.S. in China, 1/40th relative to U.S. in India. And so therefore, what companies need to do really is to almost like reinventing the business model from the ground up, because you need ultra-low-cost products and services and ultra-low-cost ways of marketing and distributing them in order to capture that market.
Yeah, and what has happened, I guess, with targeting only the cream of the crop, as you say, is that they haven't really reinvented any products. They simply slap a different label on and push the same products there as they would to the U.S. or to Europe.
Or let's say, adaptation at the margins, some kind of defeaturing and so on. And of course, you know, you do need to adapt to every market, even if when you go to Germany, to the local language, to the local culture, to the local distribution channels. So going going after the cream at the top still is really adaptation at the margin. And of course, companies should do that. So I have nothing at all to argue against that. That's a good strategy. My only point is that if that's all that the company does, unless, you are selling Porsche cars or Chanel perfume or Louis Vuitton bags, then of course you just focus on the top. But if you are a Toyota, a Sony, then a Procter & Gamble, a GE, then you really have to go after, in fact, the whole market.
You also see India and China as enormous sources for potential innovation, as opposed to the way we've looked at them, which is as places to sort of put manufacturing or outsource labor. Why are so many North American companies blind to this?
I think it's partly because, I would say it's probably two reasons. Number one is that China and India as innovation platforms, that's a relatively recent story. I would say, maybe like 5 years, whereas China and India as, let's say, low-cost platforms, that story has been playing out for 15 to 20 years. So, number one, it's just a relatively recent story, so it's now beginning to make its way onto the radar screen. That's number one. Number two is that China and India are very different from other poor emerging economies that multinational companies have dealt with. See, because China and India are really, each of these two countries is a land of contrasts. That you have some of the largest numbers of billionaires in the world in both China and India, but you also have some of the largest numbers of the really poor. And so therefore, what it means is that you have world-class engineering schools, world-class science schools in both China and India, but you also have, of course, mass illiteracy. And that if we think of China and India from a legacy image of poor, low per capita income, high levels of illiteracy, particularly in India, then we wouldn't think of these as hotbeds of innovation. But then, you look at what's been happening. Both China and India are, of course, nuclear powers, much of it developed indigenously. They both are space powers. They both have sent spacecraft to orbit the moon. China has had spacewalks. India, in fact, the Tata Motors, the Nano, as an example of both technological but also business model innovation, product innovation. And the Tata Nano is now just about to get rolled out commercially in India. And in fact, they are looking to sell a souped-up version of the Nano in Europe, and then, you know, not too long thereafter, a souped-up version in the U.S.
This is the $2,000 car that already sort of meets at least European standards.
Yes, and it would, again, you know, it depends on what standards we are talking about, you know, because there are, of course, safety standards, emission standards, but then also market standards. So I wouldn't say that it meets all of these standards yet, but the key is not whether for $2,000 it meets European or American standards. Because let's say you take the Tata Nano that will be sold in India and you bring it up to meet European standards, and then you sell it for, let's say, half the price of a European competitor. You know, let's say you sell it for $5,000 or $6,000 in Europe, not for $2,000, but then you go head-to-head against a car that sells for $10,000 or $12,000. That's what the other established car companies need to be worried about.
And that Tata Motors is a great example of your fourth platform here, which is the idea that there are huge opportunities for companies that originate in India and China to become fully globally competitive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you see, we have seen in some ways this story play out with the rise of Toyota, Sony, Samsung, Hyundai, LG from Japan and South Korea since the 1970s. But there is a difference between the emerging competitors, emerging global players from China and India vis-a-vis the Japanese, South Koreans, is that the Japanese and South Korean companies, they essentially grew organically. I mean, there hardly any, maybe none, no acquisition that I'm aware of that Toyota made, certainly nothing of significant size, or similarly Hyundai or LG and others. Whereas the Indian and Chinese global players, because they are emerging as on the global scene today, are doing so very, very aggressively through mergers and acquisitions. And so therefore, what took Toyota 30 years to go from, let's say, a mid-sized domestic company to a global giant could take only 10 or 15 years now.
And the other big difference between the economies of South Korea and Japan, as successful as they have been over the past several decades, is the fact that their populations ultimately will sort of limit their place in the global market.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, the Japan and South Korea are very, very impressive stories. But the thing is that if we just look at the sheer scale of China and India versus the bigger of the other two, which is Japan, 120 million people, that's 40% of U.S. population, which means that as Japan became a rich economy and its per capita income became equal to that of the U.S. or Germany or Switzerland, that essentially Japan had to become a mature economy. You know, it could grow at maybe, if it had great policies, it could grow at 2.5%. If it didn't have such good policies, it could grow at 1%, which is roughly what happened in the 1990s. But there is no way that when you become a rich economy like Japan, you could grow at 8 or 10%. Translated, Japan's economy more or less had to peak at 40% of U.S. GDP. Impressive achievement. You know, Japan and South Korea, two other countries, joined the rich countries club. But they don't alter the structure of the global economy. China, on the other hand, and similarly India, you know, when China and I anticipate that somewhere around 2025 is when, or maybe earlier, is that China's GDP catches up, equals that of the U.S. China's per capita income at that time still will be less than one-fourth that of the U.S., which means that its cost structure will still be quite low relative to the U.S. It also means that China would still have plenty of room for productivity growth. And so therefore, China's economy will not only catch up with the U.S., but actually move ahead. India following China by about 12 years, and India will do the same by sometime, you know, 2040. So therefore, the rise of China and India will be not just two countries joining the rich countries club over time, but actually altering the structure of the global economy.
So let's talk about some of the companies that have guessed wrong that are based in the United States. I think one of the starkest examples in the book is AT&T. They got into the cell phone market, which arguably has completely transformed life in India, and then pulled out.
That's right. That's right. And that's a case of actually, you know, not kind of taking the long-term view. And here, the long-term view, I'm not talking about taking a 50-year view, you know, even a 10-year view, because, you know, AT&T entered India in the late 1990s via a three-way joint venture with two other Indian companies to set up a mobile phone operator. In 2005, you know, they needed some cash, and so they sold out their share of the, you know, one-third share of the ownership to the other two players for $250 million, you know. And then if they had stuck around, because now AT&T, you know, wants to get back into India, because India has the second largest number of mobile subscribers in the world, and that's still growing at about 9 or 10 million new subscribers a month. And so AT&T wants to get back, you know. But today, even after all the, let's say, the collapse in the stock prices that has taken place globally, you know, it would cost AT&T almost like $2 billion, if you will, or if they hadn't sold their stake, that would be worth about $2 billion at least. So that's an example, and that's, here we're talking, what, 3 years? So that's an example of not taking the long-term view. And by long-term view, I mean like 5 to 10 years. I don't mean 20, 40 years.
One caveat that you would offer to corporations is to never assume that they understand China and India completely based on their activities in the largest cities in those areas. Can you talk about how significant the rural and small city populations are in fully comprehending the way these economies are moving?
Yeah. That's an interesting point. You know, of course, anybody who goes to China first—not anybody, but almost anybody—I guess the first place or first city that they would visit would be perhaps either Shanghai or Beijing. And of course, you know, Shanghai or Beijing are clearly, they are part of China. They are Chinese cities, very much so. But then let's take the bigger of the two. Let's take Shanghai. So Shanghai is about 17, 18 million people. Now, and China is 1.3 billion people. So Shanghai is about, you know, 1.2% of China's population. But then you go to city number two, you go to city number three, and you go on down. Let's say you go to city number 25. And, of course, city number 25 is not going to be anything like Shanghai, either in size or in per capita income or in infrastructure. And so therefore, looking at city number 25 in China actually is not at all like looking at Shanghai. Or another way to put it, if we understand what Shanghai, you know, what makes Shanghai tick, we don't really understand what makes city number 25 in China tick. But all the top 25 cities in China by population put together still is less than 10% of China's population. So understanding city number one doesn't tell us much about city number 25. Understanding all of the 25 cities in China doesn't really tell us about the rural market in China. The same story, knowing Mumbai, Bangalore, Delhi doesn't really tell us about city number 25 in India, and that doesn't tell us anything about the reality of the rural market in India.
My guest is Anil K. Gupta. He is professor of strategy and organization at the University of Maryland at College Park. His new book is called Getting China and India Right, Strategies for Leveraging the World's Fastest Growing Economies for Global Advantage. We'll return to the conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us. You can call 1-800-933-5372 or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Professor of Strategy and Organization at the University of Maryland at College Park, Anil K. Gupta. His new book, written with Haiyan Wang, is called Getting China and India Right, Strategies for Leveraging the World's Fastest Growing Economies for Global Advantage. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. Anil, how far in the future do you think it will be before multinational corporations literally cannot survive without a significant presence in China and India?
I think, of course, if you look at, is any company getting China and India right? I would say yes. A small subset are, and some of the companies I would identify at the leading edge would be IBM, Cisco, GE, Procter & Gamble, Yum Brands, Nokia. These are examples of companies that understand the multifaceted reality, that understand the dynamic, rapid change that is taking place in China and India, and that have figured out how to really leverage it for global advantage for their respective companies. But I think if we look ahead and we say that, what would be the structure of the 500 global Fortune 500 companies in, say, 2020? And just to simplify a little bit, let's assume that there are 50 major industries and that the top 10 companies in each industry comprise the Fortune 500. So I'm simplifying a little, of course, because the number of companies is not the same across industries and so on, is that today, out of those top 10 companies in every industry, about 9 and maybe all 10 would be from the developed economies, U.S., Europe, Japan, primarily U.S. But then I think it's safe to say that by 2020, 2025, out of the top 10 companies in every industry, chances are pretty high that 4 or 5 of them will be headquartered in China and India, companies that we may not necessarily have heard of. And so as these new players become global champions, and some of the existing players like the IBMs and Procter & Gambles continue to be dominant players in their industries, the question to ask is, so then what happens to the players that are in the top 10 in the world today in their respective industries, but really are not looking at China and India the way, the multidimensional, the rapid pace of change, that the way they need to? Is that these companies either will get pushed aside by the Ciscos and Procter & Gambles of today, or they will get pushed aside by the Tata Motors and Huawei Technologies from India and China, the new emerging global players. Because as China and India, as these economies continue to power ahead, and as they continue to acquire bulk, somebody is going to go after that market, because that market is not going to remain unserved. And whoever goes after that market will be big. Now, that could be a Cisco, that could be a Huawei Technologies, that could be a Toyota, or that could be a Tata. But whoever occupies that market, they will have scale, they will have low-cost structure, they will have innovation and R&D hubs in China and India. And in today's global economy, they will therefore have every reason to and the capability to come and attack established players within the U.S. and Europe and to acquire them.
One really interesting variable in all of this is not only the increasing competition for market share in India and China, but for talented professionals to fill the jobs required to produce these products and services.
Yes. And, what's happening is that if we talk about, say, blue-collar staff, or we talk about entry-level engineers, then actually there is no shortage. And the reason for that being is that it's certainly for blue collar, it's relatively easy for supply to catch up with demand, because all it largely requires is for farmers or workers to move from the farms to factories. And that can happen fairly quickly and has been happening. At the college level also, generally it's not a big challenge in terms of at least sheer numbers and technical qualifications, because China used to produce about 1 million college graduates in 2001. Now they produce about over 6 million, six times in about 8 years. Of course, China's economy has powered ahead but not by 6 times in 8 years. So the supply of college graduates has gone up tremendously. Similarly, in India, the supply of college graduates over the last 10, 12 years, has gone up by about 3 to 4 times. And so I think at that level, there is generally not a problem in terms of the availability of people. They still need to be trained in terms of the company's own requirements and so on, but not a problem. The real problem is when we talk about seasoned, experienced professionals, when we talk about middle managers, senior managers, because at that level, you see, experience is not something you can kind of force feed. It takes time. And the economies have been growing much faster than the supply of seasoned professionals. Also, what's happening is that not only is the demand growing just because of growth in the economy, but a lot of multinationals that historically used to have expatriate managers running, you know, at the senior levels, that as China and India become big, that they are moving towards localization of management. So therefore, there is also, you know, what I would say, a structural shift in the demand for seasoned local nationals to be managers within China and India.
So what are the most successful multinational corporations doing in order to identify and, when necessary, cultivate local talent in China and India?
I think the number one, you know, which is just a base-level starting point, is that, you know, the one has to be competitive in terms of market competitive in terms of compensation and salary. But that's, you know, just a license to play the game. Otherwise, you know, the company is not even likely to get noticed by potential employees. But I think going beyond that, several things. Number one is that within China and India, relative to, let's say, the case would be in the U.S., that companies need to invest more money in training. So what do I mean by that? Is that the staff, and, you know, here even, let's say, people 22 to 25 year old, that they would come with the necessary technical training, but it doesn't mean that they know how to apply the theories that they have learned into practice. It doesn't mean that they have communication skills, that they have skills at working in teams, that they have skills at making presentations that attract the interest of the people listening to the presentations. Maybe even simple things, like they may not even know how to dress in a polished manner. And so there is a need for that upfront training. What, you know, the language, particularly in India, that is used is that to convert people who are trained into people who are employable. Okay, so the employability problem. So that's number one. But then the going beyond that, that what companies have to think about is that in this brutal competition, how do they see that talented either engineer or a mid-level manager, how do they help that person see a long-term future with the company? Which means that they have to, of course, be competitive in terms of compensation. Is can they help that person see that, look, you know, you're not just a part of our China resource pool, but that you have the potential to be, and you are viewed as part of our global resource pool. That you may be hired in China, you may be hired in India, but, you know, you could be posted to Singapore, or you could be posted to Germany, or you could be posted to Japan, or wherever else, because that's where multinational companies are likely to have an advantage over purely domestic companies.
Anil, what do you see as the most significant risks to corporations that decide to do a significant amount of business in and with India and China? And are those risks different from one country to the other?
I think the risks are there, and the risks have to do with, and the risks are partly similar, partly different. So, you know, if I pick on the similarity part, is that because both China and India are changing very, very rapidly, you know, one measure of change is we look at, say, GDP growth. If we assume that growth in GDP in many ways changes a society, whether it's buying power or its habits or even culture or how different generations behave, how they interact with each other and so on. That, you know, China has been growing at about 11%, India at about 9%, U.S., let's say, at about 2, 2.5%, and taking, you know, going back last 5-10 years, not just the last, you know, 6 months, which means that China and India have been growing at 4 to 5 times the rate of the U.S. Another way of looking at it is that the magnitude of change that we may see taking place in the U.S. In 10 years, that kind of change may take place in China or in India in 2 years. And when you have such massive pace of change in the marketplace, then a challenge for companies is that you can be either behind the curve or get a little bit too far ahead of the curve. So you may predict the general direction correctly, but you may end up making investments that are, let's say, 2 years too early and end up being too expensive. And so that's a real challenge for companies. It's a, you know, it's not a pathology. It's just a challenge of dealing with any rapidly growing market. So that's number one. Number two is that for companies is, let's say, you know, in both, again, China and India, is to not think through when you need a partner, let's say a joint venture or a strategic alliance partner. And I've seen many companies that make the mistake of taking on partners when they don't need to, or not taking on partners when they do need to, even when they take on partners, to make mistakes in saying, you know, do we need one partner for the whole country, or do we need regional partners, in terms of selecting the wrong partners, in terms of not establishing the right terms on which the two sides will work together. And so these are, because you see, I mean, China and India are very different from the U.S., so a lot of companies feel that we don't know enough, or we don't have the necessary channel structure, or we don't have the necessary government relationships, and so they feel maybe we should work with a partner. All of this makes sense, you know, but sometimes you need a partner, and sometimes, you know, you can hire people to navigate and help the company bridge the distance that it needs to bridge. And so that's sort of another mistake that I've seen many companies make.
Two very different kinds of governments between India and China. Obviously, that's something that companies also need to learn to navigate.
Two very different kinds of governments. That is true. And yes, and companies have to learn to navigate that. But at the same time, I think governments in both China and India play a significant role. In China, perhaps to some extent, more than in India. You know, but even in China, despite, let's say, on the surface, you know, we may think of a monolithic political system, Communist Party of China, that rules the country. Well, yes and no, meaning that, of course, the Communist Party of China rules the country. But, you know, ultimately, the Chinese government, if you will, it's at the central level, it's run by various ministries, and then you've got the different provinces. You got the counties, you got the cities, and you know, and the you know, different provinces have their governors, and different cities have their mayors, and at the central level, the various ministries don't always see eye to eye. The provinces don't always agree with the central government, and of course, many provinces don't agree with each other. And the same thing with cities vis-a-vis provinces and the government and the central government. So it has happened, for instance, that a company may say, you know, hey, I got all the necessary clearance from the central government, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you can, you know, open a factory and start doing business, because the local government may not actually have given you the clearance, or vice versa. So therefore, despite the fact of a Communist Party of China, you know, at least on the surface, running the country single-handedly, political power in China actually is quite diffused. And, of course, in any democratic country, any democratic society like India's, political power is highly diffused. So I think companies need to understand the political landscape and the diffused political landscape, diffused political power in both China and India, you know, because you could be blindsided. You get clearance from one arm of the government at one level of the government, and suddenly you find you're running into obstructions from another arm.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Tim in Aledo. Hi, Tim.
Hi there. Yeah, I was interested in his opinion about renewable energy policy in India and China, and if he sees cooperation and subsidies and incentives coming from the government in the past. Both, I think, India and China have kind of resisted carbon limits because they point out that developed countries put most of the CO2 in the atmosphere. I was just wondering what he thought about that.
Thanks
yeah,
for your call.
I think that's a very, very valid observation that both China and India have resisted agreeing to caps because, you know, one side, the China and India argue that the rich countries have, you know, put most of it up there. And also they say that, look, hey, you know, don't look at just the total CO2 emission, look at per capita emission, and per capita emissions from, say, the U.S. or Europe are much higher than the per capita emissions from China and India. So, you know, that debate goes on, although I'm getting optimistic that, both sides will come to an agreement. But going to the other part of your question, Tim, is that our governments in China and India are doing anything on the renewable energy side? And I would say yes. And in fact, in both countries, and I would say perhaps in China more aggressively than in India. And again, you know, China's economy is three times as large as that of India. So the Chinese government has a lot more money to make long-term investments, is that incentives to move towards more efficient productive capacity. So, for example, in the steel industry, in the auto industry, in the power sector, concerted move to consolidate these respective industries to let bigger companies, the more energy efficient, the cleaner technology companies to be the survivors, and for the others essentially to get bought out or be shut down. A big incentive given by the Chinese government for cars that are lower liter capacity, more efficient cars, cleaner cars. So I think, and so clearly on both countries are pushing quite aggressively.
Need to take a quick break, Anil. The book is called Getting China and India Right. We'll be back in just a minute with my guest, Anil K. Gupta.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Anil K. Gupta. His new book is called Getting China and India Right, Strategies for Leveraging the World's Fastest Growing Economies for Global Advantage. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Before the break, Anil, you were talking about the more aggressive policies in terms of environmental responsibility, even within India and particularly within China.
Yes. Just to complete that part is that, you know, again, both China and India, a huge chunk of their import bill goes for oil. So therefore, the situation is recognized as humongously critical for both by the governments in both countries, that they need to pursue renewable energy, much more, you know, efficient sources. But also another, you know, it's not renewable energy, but certainly it's non-fossil energy, which is nuclear, is that both China and India currently get about, you know, 3%, 3-4% of their electricity from nuclear power. Now, if we compare what does 3-4% mean, that when we look at U.S., Western Europe, Japan, you're talking numbers like 25%, 30%. If you look at France, you're talking like 70%. So therefore, compared to the other top 10 economies in the world, the extent to which China and India currently rely on nuclear power is like one-tenth of their total electricity needs. And I think clearly nuclear power cannot be the only answer to the energy problem, energy scarcity in China and India, but that's got to be one part of that solution.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have Robbie in Plano. Hello, Robbie.
Hello. Thank you. You know, one way to get China and India right is to make sure all the multinationals could make sure that the quality of the service or the quality of the goods that they make available in these countries is consistent with what we get over here. What I find is that the same company selling subpar quality goods in India, and I'm sure it's there even in China, that makes you wonder whether they have different quality standards or they have different policies that govern it. For example, Toyota sells their cars in India, and you will be hard pressed to compare them with what they sell over here. And you can go down the list. Procter & Gamble products are not the same what you get over here. So I wonder if you guys could comment on, is this something that, I'm sure it's not deliberate, but is this something that the companies are not able to control? And why is there such a big discrepancy in what they sell over there and what we find over here?
Interesting point. Thank you.
Yeah, I think the observation is quite correct. That if you were to take most industries, compare the quality average China, quality average India, it is likely to be lower than the quality average in the U.S. Very true. I would say, actually, that it's deliberate. So I wouldn't say that it's non-deliberate, but I would say it's not deliberate, let's say, a pathologically deliberate reason, but deliberate in the sense that the buying power of customers in China and India is significantly lower than that of the customers in the U.S. And so therefore, and ultimately, you know, quality depends on many, of course, quality depends on how you organize and manage your production process, your operations. But it does depend on what kind of materials you're willing to put into the product, what kind of packaging you're willing to put into the product. Again, you know, it's like you take, let's say, a car, you know, and Mercedes, for instance, you know, is designed, or Lexus is designed, that it shouldn't need a service of any kind, let's say, for X number of months, which means that the parts that go into the car are a lot more reliable, a lot more durable, made of more expensive materials. So I think it's that drive to get the price point down to what the market can bear is what leads many companies to create what, you know, some people say are quote-unquote good enough products. And I'm not sure that I would necessarily disagree with this approach because, you know, companies, even the best of companies that are not pathological, they still have to have economically viable business models.
We've heard a lot this week, Anil, about China's call for a new international currency to be created to sort of push the world off the dollar. And while no one thinks that that's about to happen anytime soon, I wonder what you make of that in evaluating China's plan for itself vis-a-vis the dominance of the United States and of the U.S. dollar.
That is an interesting development, is it not?
Yeah.
Indeed, yeah. In fact, I'm generally in favor of that idea. Let me give you my own reasons why I think I'm in favor of the idea, which is just do some back-of-the-envelope analysis. Let's assume between now and 2025, China's GDP grows at 6% a year. So you're not talking 8, 10, 11, 13, but 6. And that seems very reasonable given all kinds of projections that McKinsey, Goldman Sachs, CIA, and others make about China's economy next 20 years. Let's assume U.S. GDP grows at 2.5, that we come out of the current recession, grow at 2.5, and let's assume that China's Chinese currency appreciates at about 4% a year. China's GDP becomes equal to the U.S. by 2025, if not earlier. What that means is that when you have China, a single country with a GDP that's equal to the U.S. and moving ahead, it's hard to imagine that the dollar remains kind of the key reserve currency of the world, because now you will have an economy that's going to be as big and, in fact, moving towards becoming bigger than the U.S. So I think if we take a 20-year time frame, the fact that we will move away from dollar as basically the prime reserve currency of the world, I think that's a given. The question now is, from, say, the U.S. perspective, forget the Chinese perspective, from the U.S. perspective, do we want a world where the yuan, Chinese yuan, becomes the reserve currency? Probably not. So if we assume that China will become this massive economic power within the next 15 plus years, or 15 to 20 years, then I think for the U.S. also, it is better that there be a neutral global currency that's not the Chinese yuan or the euro. And, you know, if it is not going to be the dollar, if it's going to be something else. So I think fundamentally, it's a good idea, but to move to any such neutral global currency, is something that's going to take 2 decades.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Neha in Dallas. Hi, Neha.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
I have a couple of questions. Actually, there's about three questions which are sort of interrelated, and I'll just rattle them all off. One of my first and fundamental questions was, you know, being Indian myself and having worked both in India and in the U.S., an observation, and this came out in the Economist special edition at the end of last year, was the absolute dilapidated state of Indian infrastructure, and that's probably why China is, you know, ahead of the game, or one of the big reasons why China is ahead of the game compared to India. And what is that impact? You know, it's all very well when we talk about software companies and services companies kind of making India or China their headquarters and so on and so forth. But when it comes down to just absolute infrastructure needs, power, it's actually pretty despicable, the state of Indian affairs, because 85% of the Indian states are losing over 80% in their power sector, and 25% are you know, the upper 80% of the bracket revenue-wise. So, that, you know, how is that seen as an impact with respect to getting industry in India and revolutionizing that?
Yeah. On the infrastructure side, I think your observation is right on, that the IT services industry in India, it's essentially what I would call it a prestige industry. It gives India a great image, but it really doesn't make much of a difference to to India's economy, because at the end of the day, the whole IT services industry, exports and domestic combined, is about 5% of India's GDP. And so even if it continues to grow at 20-25% rate, you know, if it's 5%, that's not really what's going to make India rich. It has to be the manufacturing revolution, which is what made China much richer than India. And manufacturing revolution requires infrastructure. It requires physical infrastructure. Absolutely correct. On the other side, I would say, let's say on a more quote-unquote positive note, that the infrastructure revolution in China really began in 1996. About the first highway in China of any kind was built in 1996. So in 10 years, China really transformed its infrastructure. The infrastructure revolution in India began about a couple of years ago. And so, you know, within 10 years, India's infrastructure, it may not look like China's today, just because in a chaotic democracy, you cannot implement things with the speed with which China can. So let's say it might take India 15 years instead of China's 10. But the infrastructure revolution in India has begun, and it's in full swing. So that's number one. Number two is that in India, the cities, Mumbai and Delhi and Bangalore, will continue to look chaotic, and it may be 25, 30 years before they begin to look like Shanghai or Beijing, because India cannot move 2 million people from the city center onto, you know, to the outskirts of the city as, say, China can. And so, therefore, India's cities will continue to look crummy. On the other hand, that's not particularly critical for manufacturing revolution, because nobody is going to put factories in the middle of the city anyway. So what India needs for manufacturing revolution really is the interstate highways and intrastate expressways. Fortunately, building those needs capital is not much of a political problem, because you are really going through farms, so therefore the number of people who's lands need to be acquired is much smaller. And so therefore, I think the way we are likely to see in India over the next 10 years is massive development of interstate highways, intrastate expressways, but still crummy-looking cities.
India and China, of course, are great trading partners with each other. My understanding is that China is actually India's number one trading partner. But there is also a significant amount of tension between those two states. How does that play into their potential for growth and their hospitable nature for multinationals coming in to work in one or both countries?
Yeah, I think, you know, the tension between the two is partly political, partly economic. Political because both China and India, I know they went to war with each other in 1962. India lost, and so India is still very, very sensitive about it and doesn't really trust China. The other thing is, and of course, you know, geopolitically, India is now totally aligned with the U.S., with the West, and it's not clear, you know, where China stands. You know, is it China versus the West or China and the West? So there are these political tensions. Economically, because China has built itself into the factory of the world as a manufacturing powerhouse, that a lot of Chinese goods are cheaper than Indian goods. And so, therefore, China can export goods to India. India, on the other hand, excels in IT services. But IT services are very language-dependent. And so, therefore, India cannot really export IT services to China. And so, therefore, India runs a trade imbalance, a trade deficit with China. So therefore, there is this economic tension. I don't see either the political tension or the economic tension going away anytime soon. Fortunately, both China and India belong to the WTO, and they are committed to free trade. So therefore, they continue to do a lot of business with each other. Trade between China and India growing at over 50% a year, while global trade is growing at only about 23% a year, I mean, not counting the last 12 months, but, you know, in the last 10 years. And so I think the only long-term resolution of the trade tensions I see happening when India takes care of its infrastructure, becomes a manufacturing powerhouse, because India's labor costs today are already lower than China's. And so therefore, if India takes care of the infrastructure, and India has the engineering talent, engineering capability. So if you have lower labor costs, you have scalable labor, you have strong engineering capabilities, and you take care of the infrastructure, then India in about 10 to 12 years could China pretty strong head-to-head competition.
Anil K. Gupta's new book is called Getting China and India Right, Strategies for Leveraging the World's Fastest Growing Economies for Global Advantage. Anil, it has been fascinating. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.